This is a talk from BeThinking.org, which is UCCF's apologetic website. Apologetics is basically two things. It's the communication and the defence of the Christian gospel. So visit BeThinking.org soon, and make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to hear all about BeThinking.org's latest releases. I feel light
in your arms. Thank you. I know about a sea captain who every time he went on a boat got seasick. I know about a preacher, every time he went on the pulpit he was very, very nervous. And I think the greatest gift God gave me is that I'm never nervous. Tonight I'm a little bit, because I'm giving a new lecture, and you never know how long it will be. I tried it out last week at La Brea. That was my trying out ground. They will have to listen to all kinds of strange things, because they're tryouts, and sometimes they don't work. Well, it was too long, so I made it shorter, but I added so much in between, so that maybe it's again very long. So that's a real problem. In my head are many, many things I want to say, much more than is in this paper, and I really can't squeeze it in. And in a way, I presume one thing, and that is those things that have been said before, all the discussions that have been said before. Just like this morning, there was said quite rightly that we cannot always repeat again the first questions. Of course, always new people come in, and they got to have these first questions answered. But we got to go on. So in a way, I want to try to go on without being too far off, I hope. But some things I just take for granted, and some things that ought to be said, I'm not saying tonight. I have found a crazy title. That is, The Artist Needs No Justification. As usual, I'm speaking mainly about the visual arts, but it, I hope, applies also to many other kinds of art. Don't put all the lights out, because then I don't see anything anymore. And I need some notes. I'm one of these gentlemen that always speak without notes, unless I have to speak without slides. They are my notes, you know. So now I really have to read something, otherwise I really get lost. So if we think about for one moment about art, what it has meant in the past. So in the Middle Ages, I'm just talking about European culture. In the Middle Ages, and for quite a time after that, art was a part of life, an integral part of life. Nobody thought about, shall we add some art to it when they were making a church or making a building, because that was obvious. So art was part of life in its manifold aspects. And the artists, it's amazing if you look at it and begin to think of it, how young they were when they made work, and how well they worked, and how easily things were made. And still, now, many of us, I would say particularly the English, but Europeans have some of that germs in their life, in their body too, we go and look at old churches. We look at a very good 15th century dome, for instance, that you find in one of those guidebooks. Very nice dome. And we look at all these little churches and buildings and cottages and old pewter, and we love it, and it has a quality which is very special. The question is, why is it all so good, and how were these artists able to do all these things, to produce? Well, they were not all great artists, they were not great geniuses, they hadn't studied that much maybe, but they made something that was very solid and very real. And I think that the answer is that there was a very great tradition. Now, tradition in a way is that there are patterns, schemes, ways of doing which are obvious. In a way, the most obvious things are the question marks. For an art historian, for a cultural historian, if you look back in history, then the obvious is exactly the question mark. To come back to our own time, sometimes we say, but that's obvious, and I've learned just to say, well, put a question mark behind that and let's think about it. But there was a strong tradition. And the tradition was given to these people. So if you asked an architect to make a church, he didn't sit down to think, what is a church and how does it work? He just made a church. And, of course, some people made better churches than others. But even if he was a bad architect, at least a reasonable thing came out. It was based, these patterns, these schemes, these obvious things were based on a common understanding of life, and they expressed a common quality of life. But within that framework of tradition, there was very much a freedom. So there was freedom for the artist within the framework. And he didn't think about tradition. He never talked about tradition because that was the obvious. If I talk about the arts in this way, what am I talking about? And I'm talking about mainly 4 points. So one is, first is, that art is embellishing things and forming things, like pottery, silver, furniture, building, in a way also sculpture and painting and so on. It is just to embellish things and to form things. The second thing that I'm thinking about, if I think about a visual art, is portraying things. It's visual communication. And then we can go on to the third point, that is telling stories or representing events. We do that in many, many ways, and we have done that in many ways. Remember the very fine, excellent 15th century Doom that was telling a story. And then there is the last point, making tangible symbols and visual metaphors of ideas and beliefs. These are the icons and the idols. They are an expression of communal beliefs and aims. So they are that what the society stands for, what the group stands for, and they are the great things that are in a way in the center of a culture, like David's Michelangelo or the great Madonnas by Raphael or things like that, or maybe the fountains on the Piazza Navona by Bernini. Things like that, they are the great things, the tangible symbols and visual metaphors of a community, a society. Now, since the 18th century, and the 18th century is really a very deep turning point, many things changed. And the first three things that I was talking about, embellishing things, portraying, telling stories, in a way became less important. People said, oh, that's only a craft. No, to make these great symbols, that is only art. So art became art, but now with a capital A, and people began to talk about the fine arts. But the very interesting thing is, and the very distressing thing is, that very soon there was a decay in taste. There was a break between art and society. Art became not necessary anymore. It became a luxury. It became a kind of religion. The artist became alienated from society and from reality. And everywhere ugliness was around. There was kitsch, as we say in Europe, schlock in America. What do you say? And these things became a common phenomenon. So very soon we see people getting very distressed, and the beginnings of a new movement gained expression in the great exhibition of 1851, out of which the Victoria and Albert Museum grew. These things were made because people felt it's too ugly, it's too awful. People like Ruskin, Pugin before him, and then William Morris and Crane, the Pre-Raphaelites, they talked about these things and they tried to find a solution. They tried to make life beautiful again. They tried to bring life in the world again. Of course, they thought very high about art, but art, as they saw it, was art in all these parts that I just talked about, not only the great icon or the great idol or the great thing, but just the very small things, like William Morris made fabrics and wallpapers and so on. The culprit, because he tried to analyze and understand, their culprit was the Industrial Revolution and capitalism. They saw there was a break here, a break with the past and a break in society, and they said the Industrial Revolution, that's the reason for it, and capitalism. And so they tried to solve these problems. In a way, their program for the future, as far as art is concerned, was a nostalgia for the past. They tried to go back to the past. Very interestingly, in the early 1850s, Ruskin took a chapter out of one of his books. It was called The Nature of Gothic, and gave that as a pamphlet to many just workmen. And he hoped that they would read this thing, The Nature of Gothic, and in this way, he tried to get life and art together again, bring art back into the world again. It's nostalgia for the past, in a way, as a program for the future. But whatever it was very clear that they saw, and I think rightly so, that art was in a crisis. There was a very deep crisis. Now, a century later, and that's why I relate these things, now a century later, more than a century later. When Ruskin and his people worked, it's, let's say, 150, 125 years ago. Now a century later, roughly a century, more than a century, where are we? And then I would say, in some senses, it's worse. In some senses, it's better. All the efforts of the people I named and many people that came after them, all these efforts, the Bauhaus and something like these people, many, many people, all these efforts, of course, came to something. And something came out of it, but I would say, let's not be too optimistic. Of course, if you live in a great center like London or in Amsterdam, in those places, it is, in a way, better. But as soon as you go out of there, maybe it is worse. And the break between art and society is very, very deep still. Those who worked for solutions in the last century and since then, in our century, everybody has said, after long, long thinking, art is wrong, but you can never change it unless you change society. Society has to change, and I would say, yes, you're right. Art's problems are society's problems, or at least they are the expression of society's problems. Capitalism, commercialism, these things have to be done away with if we want to have a good society again and a good art. That's right. But let's be a little bit careful, because if you look at the communist countries, art is not in a better state as it is in our world. And the question is it really communism that we really have to look for? Because it hasn't worked yet, at least. So it is, in a way, too cheap to say it's just capitalism or just commercialism. Even that is too superficial a statement. Now, it's very nice to say society has to change, capitalism has to go out, commercialism has to stop, and it's one big utopia, and out of that big utopia, maybe, who knows, we'll have the great art. And I would say, we cannot wait. We cannot wait. We cannot make utopias, and certainly you who are young here, you cannot wait. Maybe in a nice future, maybe something happened. And I would warn everybody, be very careful. Of course, we can talk what revolution means, and in the sense, as Uncle George said it yesterday, I would agree with that type of revolution. But revolution that takes up the sword is bound to go off, and it may, and we must be very, very much afraid of losing our freedoms, as has happened so often in revolutions. And revolutions, there may be quick changes, that's another thing, but a revolution in the very literal sense very often destroys so much. And I don't think that out of destruction comes something new. In fact, what revolutions sometimes have done is to take away the barriers so that the real changes that were already there but couldn't be shown came really forward. That happened in the French Revolution and other revolutions. But the slow changes, these are the most effective things. These are the real changes. The changes in those things that are obvious. So at a certain moment something is obvious, and 25 years it's not obvious anymore. Then you have a real change. And these changes, that is what I really think we should aim for. Not just the surface, not just a few slogans, not a new fashion, not a new custom, not a new way of doing it on a new material whatsoever, but the deep, deep changes of those things that we take for granted. And these slow changes have to be worked at. We cannot wait till the whole of society has changed. We have to work now. And artists, I think, in these changes are in a crucial and a very difficult place. Of course, and that's what we are talking about, because we are artists and we are interested in the arts and we talk about the arts, but it's not only for artists that we talk. I think that the arts have suffered most in all these things, and maybe therefore the artist has to begin and try to fight back. It's crucial that he does. He has to be part of a renewal movement. No renewal movement will ever work unless the artist is there. He got to go ahead of it. Artists today, and particularly in the Anglo-Saxon world, have been in the world of protest, in the underground more or less. And it's in the protest against technocracy. And I think, therefore, the artist is entitled to stand and go ahead. He has to create the songs, the poems, the images, the metaphors, the books, the fictions that would make the new ideas clear, make what is not obvious, obvious. This sounds great, of course. This sounds very nice, but of course it's not easy. I'm not talking about easy things. And the difficulty is that if we ask these things of the artist, can we really ask this, because he is the economic weakest? He is the first to suffer, and he has no power. And not only that, it's not only money. A few multimillionaires could help here, but it's not only the economically weakness, it's not the lack of power, but it's so much that the artist doesn't know what he's aiming for. There's so little common sense art theory. There's certainly little consensus about what art is. So maybe we got to begin to think here again. Art has suffered the most, so let's start here. And the artist must have the courage to start over again, maybe using some remnants of the old tradition. But obviously the artist cannot do it alone. He cannot do it alone. He got to be helped. He got to be helped by thinkers, by critics, by preachers, by officials, by everybody, the listener, the looker, and everybody got to help. Today, it's obvious, it's very obvious that everything that you are going to eat and therefore have to buy in a shop has been gone through some kind of survey, and it got a stamp on it. It's good. You won't buy meat that has not a stamp of it and has been looked after. And it's obvious. Health is obvious. If something is not healthy, you cannot have it. And everybody accepts this. But beauty today is certainly not the obvious. Who cares? Who cares? It doesn't matter. Yes, it's fine. You can have your beauty. You can have all these things. Only if other values are not against it. If it's economically cheap and so on and so on. In fact, we do want things to be cheap. We want the things too cheap. Of course, we want the things cheap money-wise. And that's obvious today. We want to have it culture-wise cheap. We don't want to put efforts in it. And therefore, and in all this, it's very clear that spiritually speaking, it's very weak. Of course, we're asking the thinkers, the critics, the preachers, and the officials, and so on, to work for it. But history tells us that the art critic and the art historian, they are the people, the very people who were the first to preach the big art with a big A. They made it. They have promoted it. In England, in the 18th century, that was one of the birthplaces of this new art, and a whole book has been devoted to that. For those who are interested, just read Lipkin. And of course, if you think about philosophy, it's a big line of Kant, Schelling, Hegel, and so on, Carlyle in England, Walter Pater here, all these people who made it. And so, unless also the art critic and the art historian begins to think again, we cannot ask them to help, because they are just on the wrong side of the line. Just one little aside, and I just want to put it as an aside, because it has been discussed and will be discussed, and it shall be discussed in the future many, many times again, and that is, where is the Christian in all this? Where are the Christians? I'm not talking about churches now and all that, because I cannot talk about everything. I've talked too much about that. Christians, there's a long, long tradition of a negative attitude to culture and art. In the early Christian time, there were two streams. Some people said, let's try to come to an understanding of the great classical culture and adopt as much as we can without losing our principles. But there were others who said, no, you can't do that. You don't know how much you give in. You don't know how much you lose. And then, out of this, they began to write, and they were not aware that they were even more following a classical tradition, because in the classical tradition, there was a very strong stream of the cynics. The cynics who said, culture is no good. Maybe some of you have heard about Diogenes, who lived in Baal and had no interest in houses and so on and so on. He was a cynic. And the Christians picked up from there. Then, outside of Christianity, there was a very strong religious stream in those days, the Gnostics. And the Gnostics said, this world is a bad world. And they had an influence on Christianity. And so out of the beginnings already, Christianity picked up ideas from places where it shouldn't have been picked up, but it was, and so a negative attitude came, and it went on and on in history. It's not a new story, it's an old story. And so, in the 18th century and later, the break between art and society was really strengthened by the Christian instead of counteracted. Some Christians, of course, have just accepted and taken for granted the arts. And this could be done in a relatively Christian world as it was in the past. And of course, many of the great artists, like Bernini, like Raphael, like the makers of the Gothic cathedrals, were Christians, sometimes deep, sometimes shallow, but they were Christians. But if that's not the case anymore, we run into problems. and we should ask questions. But we didn't. We were not interested. And so we have let the old world go too easily. The tradition slipped out of our hands, and the result is very poor. So Christians and Christianity is not really in the place to help. Nevertheless, I'm very sorry, but I'm asking the Christian artist to do it. So let he be, for once, really avant-garde and stand in front of everybody else. And I think that's a very good place for the artist. He sometimes has this place in history, not always, so let he be in the front line. And I think today, in a way, the Christian artist is in the front line, also of Christianity. We're always very proud in La Brie that we've got so many artists around. It helped, has helped us too. So, now, let's go to the next point. Where lies the problem, really? We got to understand what the problem is in order to try to solve something. And of course, the Industrial Revolution was in it. And of course, capitalism was in it. And of course, the Industrial Revolution, in fact, in those days, many, many mistakes were made, and we still haven't found ways to cope with the problems that rose out of that. But I think that for the art, something else is the real problem, and that's the autonomy of art. To make art great, to make it an expression of the autonomy of man, to come out of rationalism, out of scientism, out of technology, that great man had to have an autonomous art. It was a romantic concept, art for art's sake, the great art, art with a capital A, as capital as can be. Art became a kind of religion. It had to stand for the deepest of deep things in mankind. Religion was abolished, but it's very, very nice to have a great poet, priest of culture, saying the great and deep things that ought to be said, the deepest of the deep things in mankind, and to ask a musician to do that. Art is a kind of religion in a world where religion in a way doesn't count. Art, of course, was not just making pottery or all these low things, you see. That's not art, you see. Art that got to be the icon, the great metaphor of the deeper thing in mankind. And that's only worthy of the name of art. The rest is not art at all. So only high art. And the result, of course, this is a result of a development that began somewhere at the Renaissance. And, of course, people like Michelangelo are, in a way, also responsible for this. But now the artist became the genius. Before that time, some artists said, I have a genius, somebody inside of me who whispers something in my ear. But now the artist said, no, I myself, I am the great genius. And people like Goethe and so on and so on, they stood for this. Of course, if you are a genius, like Goethe and Beethoven and Wagner and some people like that, it's good for you. Everybody bows for you. You see, you know that Beethoven didn't lift his head for the emperor because he waited till the emperor lift his head for him, because he was the great priest in culture. Well, that's very nice if you can do that. But what if you are a third-rate artist? What happens then? It is a disaster for the many. It's a disaster for the many. This has led to a crisis which has made life very difficult for many professional and also student artists. They have many questions. Why are they working? For many, it has become a kind of gratuitous action. Individualistically, they search for their own identity through and in their work. They are like the philosopher as depicted in the etching of Max Klinger that I showed a couple of days ago, a man looking in his own in a mirror at his own image. Art is said to be an expression of man's innermost being. Great sentence, listen. Art is said to be an expression of man's innermost being. But what if there's very little inside? The artist is supposed to be a genius, and geniuses cannot be taught. So the young artists are left to themselves, to find themselves and to find their own expression. They become despairing, they cry for help, but then everybody says to him, I remind you that you must look for yourself for help, because your task is to help us. Because other people got to find their identity through you. And so the poor works of these pathetic artists crumble under the load and often disintegrate. It's a very poor sight sometimes what you see. Unless one is really very strong and endowed with great talents, or, and that's another possibility, if you are filled with a powerful ego drive that may pay off, unless you have either one of these two, it is very hard to make it in the art world. Of course, many people say you shouldn't talk about these problems. We talk about great art, you know. We talk about the great artists, the true geniuses. Who cares about the rest? It's nothing. Who cares whether they are despairing? Who cares when they are hungry? Who cares? But you should realize that the great artists, the real great artists, never made autonomous art for art's sake. Men like Jan van Eyck, Raphael, Michelangelo, Leonardo, El Greco, Rembrandt, Rubens, or in another line, Bach, Mozart, or another line again, Dante, Shakespeare, Goethe, and so on. All these great artists, they would never have done what they have done if they had made any kind of autonomous art, the great art of today. In a way, they never made a work of art. They made water pieces, they wrote masses, they wrote entertainment music, they wrote a little plays, they did many things, which is not at all autonomous. And of course, what they did was prepared by many smaller artists, and what they did helped many, many other artists. Of course, that is what the great man is for. So, art is high, but it is so high that you can almost not see it anymore because the pedestal is so high and it has become meaningless for every day. It has no ties to reality. And many people ask, why art? I can do without it. Isn't it for the very few, the snobs, or the happy few, the in-circle, the initiated, the avant-garde? Of course, it's a very nice, interesting thing that in many, particularly in America, you have many courses that are called art appreciation. I think at the moment that you've got to make courses for art appreciation, something is very basically wrong in art, and that you've got to teach people to appreciate something which is obvious. You see, art has come to the museum, and the museum has become a great temple of a no-religion religion. Of course, everybody and everywhere, not only among the Christians, everywhere you find the quest, what is the meaning of art? There are symposiums for this, there are discussions about this, and all these things. So, people look at it. And I think that people are looking for the meaning of art is a sign that there's a crisis of the arts. There's not so much a crisis in the arts. There are enough artists. There's enough work. There is enough creativity. That's not the problem. The problem is not that the people aren't there, but that nobody knows what to do with the arts. It's a crisis of the arts, not a crisis in the arts. And as soon as people begin to think about it, just because they want to hold the autonomy of the arts and want to make art big, and still keep the capital A on the one hand, and nevertheless on the other hand want to bring art to society, the run of all kinds of contradictions and paradoxes. Art has to teach, they say. It's a very deep way of teaching things, deep things to mankind. But be very careful, art may not be, never be didactic. That would be very wrong. Art has to enrich life. Beautiful phrase. Is art only for the rich? You see? And these crazy problems arise. Art is needed. Of course, we got to have a decoration in our room, you know. So if you have a new house, you're going to buy some paintings. You go to the supermarket and you get it. But then everybody says, but that's not art. You see, so what is it all about? Of course, it's obvious that art is in a crisis and that the arts have suffered. The art is high, very high. But that's obvious, so I pass it by now. But a result, one of the results is that a very good artist, because everybody has so much pride in his body that he wants to be high if he can make it. So you want to have your paintings in an exhibition and everybody says that's the work of the great genius. Obviously, everybody wants to have that, you see. But everybody is trying to get at that place. Very many don't understand it. Even if you get in that place, very soon your work will be in the basement and that will be your grave. But nevertheless, many artists have not worked in the other artistic fields, the other points, embellishing life, portraying life, telling stories, and there's a great deterioration here. So we have got to a place where you have the high art on the one hand, but a very low art on the other hand. To say that art is entertainment, that means almost to say it's bad. So that means that if you are making entertainment, then everybody says that by definition bad. And nobody wants to do that, so everybody tries to get away. So after all, we get very bad entertainment. It's so low, particularly in music, that in the beginning of this century, entertainment music, was really something that was almost dead. So they went to the black Americans, who happily were out of all this development, to get a steel pill to live in their art again. And somehow something good has grown out of that. You see, art is decoration, but just look at the decoration, look at the wallpapers that are produced, look at the things that are produced, and how low they are very often. Of course, maybe I exaggerate a little bit, but just to make things clear, there are some things happily somewhere around. Of course, art, the big art, is museum art. You have to go to a museum to look for that. But the museum is, by definition, where you have things that are not needed anymore. So now somebody makes a work of art that can only be put in a museum to be revered as some kind of religious new thing. But what do people have in the streets? What do we have in our houses? What people have in their houses? Of course, in the graphics, in industrial design and in the crafts, maybe it's relatively better. The work of Ruskin and William Morris and so on, and the Bauhaus, has paid off. But of course everybody says that's not art. And those who work in this field, they all know the problems of encroaching commercialism, asking to do things that are really is catering to the low tastes of the masses. And these tastes are low, but the big question is, why is it so low? Maybe because real artists were never caring to help these poor people to have something beautiful around. Just like in times in the past, just the pewter. Pewter was cheap household furniture. You see, pewter was cheap, and it's still nevertheless beautiful. It's not only for the rich, and it wasn't only for the rich. I recently had a very interesting experience. There was a girl, and she came to La Brie, and she said, "I always dreamt to be an artist, and then I found that this society is so appallingly bad, I want to change it, and so I went into sociology. Until I found after a couple of years that sociology doesn't help the world, and so she dropped out. And then she came back to me and she said, what shall I do? Shall I become an artist? And I looked at her little work, and I said no to her, you're not good enough. But you're much better. I know that you are very good in making designs. That you're very good in making fabrics and in designing clothes. Why don't you go to such a school? She had a great effort to enter such a school. She followed my advice. I'm very much pleased about that. And she went to that school, and she tried to get in, but she was refused. And she went to the school and said, why are you refused? We said, you're much too good. You're a university kid. You don't belong here. So she had a great problems to get in. Now I spoke to her just recently, and she said, I've had 1 year, and it has a very hard working year, and they really keep you working, and they really teach you something. And all the kids that go to the academy, teach high art, they sit down there, take their drugs, jam in each other's beds, talk, and produce nothing. And I think that's a very strange situation, that really something is coming out of the graphics and the crafts much better than in the high field, very often. And we all know these situations. We all know them. Now, what do we need in order to get out of this? And I think what we need, first of all, is an analysis of this. I just gave very short little indications of this. What is the art? What means the change? What was the change in the 18th century? Where does it stand Christianity? What should Christianity do? Why has Christianity failed on this point? Or has it failed? And if it hasn't, in the past, in, let's say, the 17th century or in the Middle Ages, why didn't it fail at that time? What is life? What is the meaning of all these things? What is reality? What is the decay really means? And we got to analyze it. I have tried to do this. I set it out as a program to come to a little book like the Modern Art Book, just to hand it out to those who wanted to go on in a new movement. And I'm very thankful. Thankful to God and thankful to those who have listened to me for this that could be done. But it is a very little point of beginning, and we shouldn't say hooray. But anyhow, if I just look around at a conference like this, and if I know something about the things that were said, the very nice kind words of the introduction, I would say we are not exactly at point zero. We are beginning. But we got to go on. And a good art theory is needed. This is the next step. How do we have to look at art? What is art? So I'm going to try to say a few words about this now, and then I would go on and try to get some conclusions out of this. What is art? Now, I would say art is God's creation. You know, if you read this wonderful chapter, the most beautiful chapter in the Bible, Revelation 4, you see God on the throne, and then everybody comes, all the creatures over there, and all the elders, and they all come, and they begin to sing a great song, and the song is about creation. You are the one who created it, and nothing is there, but you willed it to be there. And so, why is art here? There's only one answer: God willed it to be there. Praise be to the Lord. Now, what does it mean if I say that something is created by God? Let's think for one moment to take something easy. A tree. A tree is meaningful because God created it. A tree is meaningful as a tree. And a tree doesn't ask for any justification. Who is ever going around to say, why is a tree there? You see, it's obvious that a tree is there, and it's a meaningful thing. Of course, a tree is beautiful. Of course, a tree has branches and the birds can sit on it. Of course, a tree makes shadow, so when the sun is blazing, you can sit under it. Of course, a tree produces wood, and the wood can be used for many, many purposes. Of course, a tree produces oxygen. The tree has many, many functions. But the beauty of it is that although the tree has these many functions, more functions than I just said, many, many functions, although the tree has all these functions, the tree's meaning is not in the function. A tree can be just looked at beautiful without realizing any of these things. A tree is not just a bunch of functions, the sum total of the function, but a tree is meaningful as a tree. Just like a human being is meaningful as a human being, even if he began before he begins to work. The meaning of our life is not in our work, but in our being. But of course, it flows out. So the tree is not just, you can never explain the tree out of a utilitarian way, as has, of course, been done by all the evolutionists and by the naturalistic sciences. You cannot just say, it's therefore and therefore and therefore. No, there's much more to it. It's meaningful, but it has functions. It's not just on its own. And for art, it's just the same. God's creatures require no justification. Their meaning is that God deemed them meaningful, and they could not be spared in the totality of his creation. He willed it to be so. And in that same way, our characteristic human assets require no justification. God said, love myself and love your neighbor. The next question is not, why should we love? And what does love mean? And has love meaning? Because it's obvious. These things are there because God made them. And when he says love, it's a command of God, but it's not justified. There's no need for justification because God willed it to be so. To marry. Why do you marry? What's the meaning of marriage? These are silly questions. It's beautiful. To praise the Lord, to till the ground, to prepare meals, to talk, feel, think. All these are so much more, need no justification. They got to be accepted out of the hands of God, and they got to say, thank you, Lord. They got to be used in the right way, yes. Often man does not use it in the right way. He doesn't use it in the context of, I love you, Lord. Not in the context of, hallowed be thy name, thy will be done. And he sinfully misuses his creation. And this takes away freedom and turns a blessing into a curse. But that's not the problem of this moment. Art needs no justification. God gave man the capacity to make beautiful things. That demands no justification, only to say, thank you, Lord, for what you gave. Because art is meaningful. It doesn't have meaning, something that we give to it. It is meaning. It's loaded with meaning. If we don't accept this gift, we are not only unthankful, we are not only disobedient, but we impoverish our life because we let our talents wither. Art needs no justification. It's not just meaningful only as an evangelistic tool or to serve a practical purpose or to be didactic. Art has to be itself, just has to be itself, and therefore it is free. It's free from politics, including church politics. It's free from the past. It's free from the present situation. It's free from the future. For those who have read my book on Gauguin know that I'm influenced at this point by Gauguin. I think he's totally right. Art is free, and the artist is free. He is not bound by any of these things. And art is free from our economic and our social needs. The artist is free. Art can never be turned into a function of any of these things without losing its meaning as an indispensable part of human life. It's a prostitution of its createdness. After all, Christ came and died for us in order to restore our humanity and to give meaning back to God's creation. Yes, God's creation is now groaning to see the fulfillment of that word. This is true of the arts as well. Yes, that's true. But they are not to be thrown away. Nor, for that matter, is any part of human life. Not only is evangelism Christian, but all of life is Christian, unless we make Christ small, the God of the Christians, and narrow our life down to the preaching of the gospel. We got to do something. We got to live. Christ died for that. The gospel is not there in order to promote the gospel, but to point the way to life, to the way, to the truth, to the life, here and now and in the future. Art is free. But being a creature, art is for art's sake. It doesn't need any justification. But when I'm saying so, I'm not talking about anything that's autonomous. I'm not talking about autonomous art, because art doesn't stand in itself. It's always relative, because it points to its maker, and it points to all of the other things that's made. It's standing in the midst of creation, and it has a part in creation, and it has a meaningful part in creation, pointing to the Lord who made it, and the other things. So you can never understand what art is if you look at it as a function of something. In a functionalistic way, you just mean it. But you shouldn't make it autonomous at the same time. You shouldn't. First, art has to be according to God's law. It's not its own lawmaker, as many modern thinkers on the arts and some modern artists think. Art is not making its own laws. God made the laws. There's a structure to art. And this has to be discovered. Of course, art has to be discovered. It's never invented. We discover things. And we, humanity, human beings, know these things. An artist is somebody who has a very special talent, and we say thank you for the special talent, but he can find out, because there's something there that God made, what it is, a good shape, a good color, a good tool, a good sound. In a way, we do this experimental, we try. And in trying out, we find out what is beautiful, what is harmonious. In a way, just like God never explains procreation, God never explains how we do walk, and never God explained how to make clothes, all these things you can find out yourself. God never in the Bible says, this is the way you got to make art, because he says, find out yourself. I gave you eyes, ears, hands, and so on. You see. And in the second place, art is related to life. And so art is not autonomous. It's tied with a thousand ties to reality. It speaks about reality. All art is always about reality, or it works into reality or in reality. So a painting talks about reality. A piece of music is about sadness, grief, or joy, or whatsoever. It's always about something. But as such, it works in reality. It has a task in reality, does something. And in the visual arts, there are two ways to look at it. You can make a diagram from 0 to 100 and 0 to 100 that way. And then on the one line, you begin with decoration. Not mere decoration, because decoration is very important. Just look at the old beautiful things. Just think about all the women in this room just having all the decorations taken away from them, all plain white dresses. Why white? Why not black? You see, all black, plain black dresses, and no fabrics, no colors, no designs. Decoration is very important. But it begins with decoration, and in the end is the great icon, the thing that stands for the deepest and the greater things in life. That's one range. And the other range is from the complete non-figurative, just the little dots, just the little squares, just the little forms, to the thing that is utterly and very precisely naturalistic. This is the visual communication. In these two lines, everywhere, you can find that the visual arts are somewhere on that line. You can make similar diagrams for the other arts. So, but if you think about this, that art goes from decoration to the icon, and it goes from the non-figurative to the extreme naturalist. If you think about this and all these possibilities, then we must think that with these means, art speaks in the world and has its place. There is no high and no low. Yes, of course there is something that's higher and something that's lower, but that's not in the sense of better and less. It is only in a different place. It has a different function. It has a different category. of course, all these four categories. To make a beautiful pot is more meaningful than making a bad painting, or maybe making a good painting. It's not less. It has a different function, a different place. There are differences, and the differences are beautifully laid out in 17th century art theory as a term that we have totally forgotten, and I want to bring it back, and that's the term decorum. Decorum, it means today something that's very solemn and in a way very sad. But decorum meant in those days that something is appropriate to its function. If you have a pageant, a parade in the city, you are not going to have in front of it an orchestra playing the Brandenburg concertos, however beautiful they are. You see, you have a brass band because you got to have march music. That's the decorum of the place. And you have, of course, your chamber orchestras, and you have your symphony orchestras, and you have your dance orchestras, and you have all these different types. And the music got to be good in all these cases, according to the decorum of the place. If you got to make a mural in a very important place, then it got to be loaded with meaning. But if you have a little nice hall in a hotel, you make something, maybe even non-figurative, just a few nice colors, just to give you a nice feeling, without deep meanings. You see, it has a decorum, and I think decorum is something we got to think about. Where do we stand? What are we making for which situation? And how does it fit in the situation? You see, and if we begin to think for a norm, of course, we have Philippians 4:8. Think about the good, the beautiful, the fine, that those things that are helpful. These norms are for art, because art and life are the same in a way. So if we come to a conclusion about this little art theory of mine, it comes down to this, that art needs no justification. It stands for its own. And the interesting thing is, the more art is itself, the more the artist is free, the more it's good for society, and it's tied with a thousand ties to reality. On the other hand, the more it's tied to everything, and it's not just thought about as a mere little thing that is nothing, but the more it is tied in reality, has a place, the more has its own meaning. Go to the museums and look at the old art. Go to the museum and look at the old art, the things that we are talking about as the very highest art of all. And what you see? You see things that had a very central place in reality. An altar piece. Why did Raphael make the Madonnas to be placed in the center of the church? Why did Michelangelo make his David to be an icon, something that stood for the meaning of Florence? And it was not just an autonomous work of art. But it is so great that today, even if these old meanings are gone, it still stands as great. We can still listen to dance music of the past, and we think that we look at something very serious. Very strange, just a little passing remark. In Holland, I don't know in your country, but in Holland we have a very curious custom. As soon as somebody very, very important dies, the radio announcer said, Mr. So-and-so, let's say the Queen has died, and so because of that, all our programs are suspended, and from that this moment on we only play serious music. So all the joy is out of the radio. Now we are solemn, you know, and very happy. These are the most joyful moments in the music, because you hear Telemann and Bach. It's joy all the day. You see, it's fantastic. And all the sadness of the pop is happily gone. Of course, if we talk about art, we not only talk about the artist, we don't talk only about the work of art, we also talk about what art is for, that is, the non-artist. Because, after all, art is not made for artists. That's one of the greatest mistakes of the autonomous art people, art for artists' sake. But, of course, it's very nice if your colleagues say you're good, but, after all, it's much better if the non-artists say, I like it. And if we think about this, what is the place of art in the world? And I would say, just to line up some little things, there's a kind of dialogue about reality. If you, let's say you saw a play tonight, you had a dialogue, now you hear the monologue, but then there was a dialogue, you see, and you had these people talking, then later on you discuss, well, what is this? What is reality? What is insanity? What does it all mean? Is it funny? Is it isn't funny? If it is funny, why is it funny? There's something about reality there. It's a kind of dialogue with reality that is in the arts, and we take part in the dialogue. And in discussing with each other, we try to ascertain and make it our own. In a way, not in a way, and that I think that is what art really is. It's our environment. We create our own environment. The music that you play, the things you have on the wall, the things you choose, you create your own environment with it. And I'm talking now about a non-artist, just by choosing these things or giving a command to an artist and ask him to do it for you. But whatever it is, an expression of yourself. And that therefore not only the artist is responsible, the people who give this, who ask the artist to do it, they are responsible. Society, the people around us, they are responsible. We are all responsible, not just the artist. And in all this, if I'm not thinking about only my little home or my little room, but if we think about our society, I would say what art is doing is creating the tools for the liturgy of life, not just the liturgy of religion, where you have your little songs, your little hymns, and maybe your stained glass window, and maybe your pulpit, but it's not just a liturgy, and of course the gowns of the preacher and the movements and so on, but it's much more the liturgy of all of life. How do we do things? How do we perform things? What do we have around us? How do we create our surroundings? And this liturgy in a wide sense of life is what the artist is called in. And he got to do that according to decorum. If you have to have the liturgy of the entrance of the hotel where you just come to check in, it's something else than in the airport, it's something else than in the church or in the town hall. These are different places, or in the courtroom. Of course, it's a play. We play things. We not only play music, but we play our actions. And of course, everybody who thinks a little bit knows that play is the most serious thing in life. Now, I hope I have prepared you and myself to think about a minute about... how do I run in time? Oh, fantastic. Yes. Now our calling. What is your, and of course my, calling? The artist, but also the non-artist, is responsible for the world we make. Of course, there are many, many more things to be said about the world we make. The lecture that you heard last night is one example, and there are many, many more. But I'm talking about the arts in that aspect, and I think it's central and important, and not making it too big. I'm not saying it's the only center or the center. I'm saying it is central. But we are responsible for the world we make. And just to pick up from where I began, I would say don't wait till things come by themselves. Because culture and history are man-made. They don't come by themselves. They are in relation to the created nature. They are related to created nature. They are related to God the Creator. We are standing before God and working together in this world that God made, and there we have to work out the world we make. And don't wait till it comes by itself. It doesn't come. We live in a world in which traditions have been broken down. There is even a tradition of today to always break down traditions. That's maybe the most typical tradition of our 20th century. You see? And therefore we have to start from scratch. It's difficult. And maybe we can start from little remnants of the traditions. But we got to start whatever we do here and now. There's a loss of unity. There is no one consensus. There is not one value system. And out of this has grown today in our permissive society a complete freedom. You can do whatever you want. In a way, it doesn't matter what you do. Just go ahead. Anything goes. Because everything is meaningless. Law and lawlessness is a result of this. Lawlessness is a term the Bible would use. Love goes cold out of this. Matthew 24, in that great sermon of Christ at the end, about the end of the world, he says there will come a day that people get lawless and love will grow cold. And the things we see around us. But there's another side to this. If there is a complete freedom today, because the old systems are there, then the new systems are not there yet, the new dictator hasn't come yet, at least not here. If that's true, then we have freedom. And I would say use the freedom to do something. Because now at this moment you're free. You wasn't free 25 years or 50 years or 100 years ago, and you won't be free in 25 years. Then the new molds are made. And if they're not made by us, they will be made by other people. So go ahead and take your freedom. Take your freedom. And of course this means that you got to think. But nobody who wants to be a great artist is free from thinking. If you think, I want to be an artist because I'm too lazy to think, forget about it and take another job. You see, you got to think. I'm not asking for intellectualism. You know enough about me, I hope. that I'm not standing for intellectualism, but I want you to ask your humanity, your total humanity, and to know what you're doing. Because art is not ready-made, and it doesn't come by itself. Of course, the things we're talking about are never finished. You're never there. It's never finished. You're always on the way. You're always going on. That's human. It's never consummated. It is to be, human is to be on the way, because life is a way. We are on the way. A couple of days ago, I read in that fantastic book, which was just released not a couple of months ago, interviews with Bacon. Read about Bacon, the great English artist, and you see a man who says, I create a world in which God is dead. He talks about a world where God is non-existent, and he takes up the clues and he works it out, and he's completely consistent, and he is very strong, and he believes in what he's doing. He is on his way. He is on his way, and he knows, this is my way. I don't believe in anything, but I want to be heroic, even if it's pathetic. But what is your way? What is our way? And of course the answer is very easy. Christ is the way. Christ is the way. But that's, what does it mean? What does it mean? Of course, when I say our way, it's very obvious that I'm not talking to individuals. I'm not talking to you and you and you alone. We cannot do these things alone. We got to do it. And that's why it's so beautiful that we have something like this art center, to do it together and to think together. And of course, it's not just a little organization, but it is the doing together, to work together in reality. But I think if we want to do it, we got to have the same quality as a man like Bacon has in his world, the quality to stand out. And so it is the quality of our Christianity that counts. The quality that you read, for instance, in Proverbs, my son, if you receive my words and treasure my commandments with you, making your ear attentive to wisdom and inclining your heart to understanding, yes, if you cry out for insight and raise your voice for understanding, if you seek it like silver and search for it like hidden treasures, then you will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. For the Lord gives wisdom. From his mouth comes knowledge and understanding. And so on and so on. This type of quality we got to work. Really to work, to think, to try to understand God's word and the world. Christianity is not sweet. There's nothing sweet about Christianity. And nothing sentimental. Save yourself. If Christianity is not about saving yourself, maybe God saves you. But it's not about saving. It's about much more. It's about life. It's about reality. It's not about saving out of the world, but it's going into the world, because God placed you here. You've got to do something, grasp it, try to understand. My son, receive my words. We ask for God's honor. We ask for understanding, for his creation. What does it mean? And the Bible, of course, is the key. And we see his hands, not only in our own lives. Maybe to say God has a plan for you can be a very blasphemous term. Maybe God doesn't have a plan for you. Maybe he says, you're free, go ahead, try to do something which is sensible. Use the talents I gave you. You see? But we got to see God's hands in this world. Not only in our lives, but in the world. We got to understand what it means when in Revelation it is said that Christ, the great Son of God, who is sitting at the right hand of God, the Lamb that was standing as slain, that he will rule the world with an iron rod. And that God is coming with his judgment. Just one little passage, just to make clear what I'm talking about. The judgment of this world, it's in Isaiah 9, 18 and so on. For wickedness, and that's what we're talking about. We live in a wicked world today. And what we see? Wickedness, because I didn't go at length into that, but when I spoke about the 18th century, of course, I would have said people discarded God and they didn't like God anymore. They wanted to be autonomous, they wanted to be their own gods, and they discarded all these things. But it was really wickedness, the pride of man. And then we see the result. People didn't want to accept God's commands. When God said, this is what I'm saying to you, man said, I know better. Wickedness burns like a fire. It consumes briars and thorns. It kindles the thickets of the forest. And they roll upwards in a column of smoke. So wickedness burns like a fire. And we see the fire around us. But you must understand, it's not just wickedness which creates its own fire, but because the text goes on, and through the wrath of the Lord of hosts, the land is burned. God goes on, and he burns. It's not only wickedness which is like a fire. No, God is burning. And we got to talk about these things. This belongs to the to the quality of our Christianity, that we can say, not save yourself, but that we can say, turn back to the Lord. Don't you see that he's coming with his judgment? Don't you see the judgment? And if we don't speak these things, we are, and I think that's one of the most beautiful American words that I know, then we are phony. So many Christians are phony. They're not really what they are. They always want. You see, Christ says, no, the Bible says that the gospel is joy and some other things. So you read, Christianity is joy. What does joy mean? A smile. And from that moment on, they all walk around with their Pepsodent smiles. You see that everybody can see for miles away how good the gospel is. But what they've seen for miles away, they never realize that people says, there you have that phony Christian, he's smiling again. But there's nothing there. You see, it's not real. And we got to be real people, not phony. Of course, if you want to use another term, it's hypocritical. We got to be real, and therefore our art has to be real. And if we don't make our art because we love art, but if we only make art in order to promote the gospel and make it therefore cheap and prostitute the art, then, of course, we are responsible for the prostitution. And again, we are phony. And the world hears it. But art got to be real as we are. And it has to come out of our real life, the freedom that we have, the love of God that we have, the love for our neighbors. And we shouldn't be ashamed. We shouldn't be ashamed of the God we have and the Christ we have. But we shouldn't be ashamed that we are we. We got just to be ourselves. Our mentality comes. Of course, you have been listening to these very good introductions of Jim Packer these days. But he was talking about the Sermon of the Mount. What is Christ teaching there? Not little laws, not little do's and don'ts, but the mentality. This is the way to walk. This is the way to do things. The mentality comes. And the mentality speaks in our words, in our works. We can never, this is something I learned in my life, in the hard and soft way, but I learned that we can never be better than we are. If you try to be better, you're always less. Because you reach too high, you reach more than you are. It's pride to try to be more than you are. We can never be better than we are, but then be yourself. Are yourselves as children of God, with your own personality, with your own beliefs, your values, your loves, your insights, your shortcomings, your sins, your hates against sin, your own sins, other people's sins, the sins of this world. Christianity is not romantic. Don't talk about the sweetness of life if you don't see any. And certainly don't have that crazy, crazy romanticism of the humanism around us that say anything goes and it doesn't matter. You can just marry and divorce and it doesn't matter. And they don't see how many lives are shattered. You see, that's another type of romanticism. Get out of this and get to the real thing and be yourself. Of course, this means that you got to think, you got to work, you got to pray, you got to do all these things, but begin to be yourselves. Be honest. As Bacon is honest. Why shouldn't Christians always try to be somebody else? They are phony, trying to be more Christian than they are, and they are phony, trying to be less Christian, to hide away their Christianity. And I think it's silly, and it's really silly. And we are not really honest. People ask me all this, if I make art, must it be always positive? Can it never be negative? And I know Dr. Schaefer says you have the positive and the negative in art. But I've learned to say, no, Dr. Schaefer, you're wrong at this point. Maybe it's a matter of definition. You always got to be positive. But you got to know that you can only be positive if you only make clear that the negative is wrong. Can you show the negatives in art? Of course you can. But you got to show it as negative. And that means that minus means plus. Even in English, that may, I hope, be clear. So, we got to fight against the evil and to expose the evil as such. And that doesn't mean always to make it very obvious. We're always so afraid that other people don't understand that they are stupid. Usually they are less stupid than we are, so let's be honest there too. Of course, I'm not just talking about themes, the subject matter. I'm talking about the motive that's behind it, the meaning, the message, which is in the form. The question is, what is communicated? And of course, you often have communicated before you do anything. You see, if you hear music before you have really heard everything and have listened to all the words that went in, you already have communicated the attitude, the mentality that's behind it. And that's what really counts. What do you communicate? An attitude, a mentality. Love your neighbor. Showing also the negative. Your hatred of sin. Art and morals. This is always a question. And I would say, of course, the better your art is, the worse it is in morals, the more it will show that it is so bad. You see, this is all well, pornography and all that doesn't matter. That's very shallow. That really, in a way, doesn't matter. But some of these, let's say, anti-Semitic films that were made by the Nazis in the 30s, they were very, very wicked because it was very, very good. These people were good in their ways, and therefore very immoral. Just because they understood in their ways that art can never be just autonomous. So I'm coming almost to the end, and I want to say this, that art, to be an artist is to be human. It seems to be silly to say so, but sometimes it has to be said. To be artist is to be human. And art is part of life. Not just art with a capital A. We talk about all these things. Art is not a kind of snobbishness. It's not for a few people. It's everything. All the arts, all the crafts, all these things. Forget about the high art. It's also for the non-artist. It's part of life, not only of the artist, but also of the non-artist. And it does not ask for justification. It is obvious. It should be obvious, at least. And then we got to add, we are responsible. Art is in the midst of life and of life's realities, and we got to work for it. Maybe against the stream of indifference, the stream of it doesn't matter, the stream of it is too expensive. We got to fight for it, and we got to try to be different. We must start with ourselves. Don't wait for all the others, and don't compromise. Don't compromise the real principles. If you are asked to do things that you feel that are wrong, don't do it. But first, think about it. See that you are not mistaken. Maybe you was just self-righteous. Maybe you was just stubborn. Maybe you was just impractical. Maybe you was too idealistic. Maybe you was even legalistic. Think about it. Whether you really work out of love for your neighbor. And if you feel, no, this is really wrong. If it's really wrong, cut off your hand and cast out your eye. That's what Christ is saying. Cut off your hand. Throw out your eye. Forget about it. If it's wrong, don't compromise in that sense. Because of this, it may be better to be free as an artist. I feel that some of the greatest artists in this art in this world was done by amateurs. Why? Because they were free. If somebody asked them to do something that they didn't like, they said, no, I have no time. You see? So maybe it's better to be an amateur, not too tied by money. You see, all the writers have been working like that, almost all of them. Except some detective writers, but the rest of them never did it. You see, all good New Orleans jazz was produced by amateurs. The best of them, if they couldn't get work that they really liked, then they worked as longshoremen. It's better to work as a longshoreman than to make bad music. I think that's a matter of principle. And we got to have something of that in our bodies if we want to do something. It shouldn't be the moloch of money that ties it. Of course, don't ask to be the genius, your own God, you see, the great artist that everybody got to bow down to. That's silly. Of course, I'm not asking when I say don't be afraid to be the amateur, I'm not saying you can be sloppy in your work and it doesn't matter. You've got to be as professionally good as you can, as possibly good as you can. But don't be afraid to be anonymous. I think that basically and in the end, all good things are done anonymously. We don't know the names of the big buildings. We don't know the names of the good sculptures that we see on the road. We don't know the names of all these people. Of course, some people do know them, and these are, of course, the inn people. Of course, if you are an architect, you know who has made that good building on the corner. It would be foolish not to know it. But the thousands that pass by it know it's a good building. Maybe they even don't realize it, but everything just fits. And it's anonymous. And I think the anonymous qualities are great. And I think the best things are anonymous. The genius idea has to be discussed. We are going to serve. And it is a Panofsky in an article on Suger, one of the greatest men of the Middle Ages, makes a very interesting distinction here. It says, Suger was the man who made the Gothic style. Michelangelo is Michelangelo. He compares it to, he says, it's interesting that of course there was great pride in Mr. Suger. Of course this man wanted to do something, but interestingly his pride and his work is centrifugal. You will see a beautiful building, you will say that's beautiful Gothic, but you never think about Suger. It's in the work. It's anonymous. While if you stand before Michelangelo, it's centripetal, it always comes back to him. So if you stand before Michelangelo, whether it's a Moses or a David or just a staircase, you say, look, Michelangelo. You see, and I think it's always coming back to the person. That's the wrong genius idea. We should be serving, and it should be go away from us. It's anonymous. forget about you and be happy if nobody knows your name, but everybody admires your work, even if it's just one of those little tools that is used in the household. You're not too good to make that. Of course, I'm not asking for asceticism. Art is a serving, it's a part of life, but it's not in the place of religion. So I come to my conclusion. The artist and the non-artist, because both are involved, they got to make, that is their task, that is the work that God gave them to do, they got to make life meaningful and livable. And of course, it's for everybody. And we talk about the environment, and the ideas, and the forms of expression, and the symbols and the metaphors, the songs, the poems, the books, the fiction, all this that make up our life. This is what such an important thing in our life is, and what is life, what art is about. Of course, art is not, life is not only art. Everybody has understood this by now, but it has such an important function in molding this environment for, let's say, the liturgy of our life. Of course, art is related to philosophy and related to wisdom, because it talks about the world and it thinks about what the world ought to be. And of course, thought and emotion and imagination and creativity, all these things are very closely tied together. As the 17th century man would have had in his little slogan, art is the utile dulci. It is what is needful and what is sweet and nice. And the beauty and the utility, they together. It's needed and sweet. Sweet not in the sentimental sense. Art and the non-artist, they and the art and the artist and the non-artist, all these things don't need any justification. But there's responsibility, because our work, their work, is meaningful. It's done together as a group, as Christians. We got to be concerned. And as individuals, we got to be concerned. So my conclusion would be that the artist needs no justification. The artist needs no justification. May the Lord help us, and may this be so. May this be a part of a beginning of a much wider renewal. It's not only in the arts, but maybe today the artist can be in the beginnings and be starting something. But certainly, whatever it is, the art should participate. You can't wait till the world has changed. We should begin somewhere. Thank you.